accompanying her. So she's the main lady here.
Okay.
Her name is Miss Dineo Musala. Miss Dineo Musala, she's a colleague of mine in the committee section. We work together as content advisor. She's a content advisor in the field of international cooperation and relations. Without wasting any time, I'm going to hand over to my colleague, Ms. Dineo Musala. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members of this committee. Thank you, Mkhize, for introducing me. I give support to the Portfolio Committee on International Relations and Cooperation, and the subject of treaties is one that the committee deals with regularly. So when I was asked to come and assist, we were only happy to come and do that. So, honourable members, with the presentation which I have already distributed, I'll go through it as fast as I can, since I would like to allow more time for questions from members. As we are all aware, since 1994, the South African Parliament was only actually concerned, engaged entirely with reviewing of laws and repealing of apartheid laws. So very little time was given to consideration of international agreements. As a result, there has been a backlog in Parliament with regard to dealing with international agreements, and there has been no formal or adopted framework within which such instruments can be dealt with by Parliament. And then since 1994, again, South Africa has been very active in the international arena, and it has become party to many bilateral and international treaties. As a result, there is a lot of work for Parliament to do in terms of oversight over those international agreements. Treaties in general are regulated internationally by a convention called the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties of 1969, and it gives certain definitions to treaties so that we know what this animal is all about. It's a binding instrument, and normally it's between states themselves, or it can even be between states and international organizations. It is governed by international law, and it has to be in writing, and it can be even, you know, more than one instrument. But what is important is that parties enter into it with an intention to be bound by it. Now, what is really of great importance to Parliament is the distinction between what we call ordinary or executive agreements and treaties. These executive or ordinary agreements, normally they implement process within an existing treaty. What this means is South Africa would have entered into a treaty with, say, Japan for general cooperation on various fields, human settlements, local government, agriculture, and so on. Then within that general agreement, there has to be sectoral agreements. And these sectoral agreements will be on specific items, for example, human settlement. So from that general agreement, there will be smaller agreements which now will be implementing the sectors stated in the general agreement. So these become ordinary or executive agreements. The main agreement would have come to Parliament, the state-to-state agreement, but for approval. But these sectoral agreements are called executive or ordinary or technical because they do not require approval by Parliament. Then with treaties, for them to be effective, they have to be ratified. Hence, Parliament will be required to approve ratification. Parliament doesn't ratify. Parliament approves ratification. Then, the executive agreements themselves, they do not have any extra budgetary implications. This means that within the budget of the department, they would have budgeted for activities around this agreement. For example, they would have budgeted, planned to have so many houses built within 3 years. Then they would have budgeted for those. So they can go out and seek funding from partner countries. So that would be taken as within the budgetary projections of the department. So long as they don't come back to Parliament to seek extra budget for projects that emanate from international agreements, those agreements are executive. So these are very important for members to note. And then again, executive agreements have no legislative implications. That means for international agreements to bind South Africa, they must have been domesticated. What we mean by that is that if a country enters into a treaty with another country or with an international organization, that treaty has to be domesticated. It has to be enacted under South African law. There must be an act of Parliament encompassing that treaty in order for it to apply in South Africa. So,
can you repeat that?
Okay, Chair.
Make an example.
Let me make an example. We have, for example, we have a treaty on rights of women, for example. Rights of women is a UN convention to which South Africa has entered into. And it has been ratified. That all the processes which are needed were done. The executive negotiated, signed, and brought it to Parliament for ratification, and Parliament ratified. Once Parliament has approved, I shouldn't say ratified, that should be also legally correct, approved ratification. Once, I'll explain why I'm saying this. Once Parliament approved ratification, the executive issued what we call an instrument of ratification to the UN to say South Africa is now willing to be bound by this instrument. So thereafter, a law was promulgated which covers the rights of women. We have our constitution, and then we have sectoral law on the rights of women for domicile rights. There are several laws within the Department of Gender and other departments which are actually implementing the Treaty on the Rights of Women. Without those laws, that treaty wouldn't be part of our law. So it is very important that this is where Parliament comes in, because all the treaties that the executive has signed and have been ratified by the executive, most of them are just sitting there without any act of Parliament making them part of our law. And as a result, they are not enforceable in South Africa. And this is where committees come in with oversight responsibility to make sure that all the treaties that each department that the committee is overseeing have been ratified and they are being implemented. Most of these international treaties, their main requirement or the main obligation for countries is legislative requirement to say make sure your constitution, I mean, and your local laws actually cover this principle, which would have agreed upon, and make sure you make the necessary administrative arrangements. For example, with things like immigration, with human settlement, you'll find that there are some administrative arrangements, measures which have to be taken in order to implement treaties. For example, they would, you know, the easiest one with immigration is you'll find that maybe you'd have to establish physical borders in order to actually designate a border between two countries. You would have to have software to record movements. All those things are implementing international instruments, which we might not be aware of, but they are there because being in a multilateral situation where South Africa now is, we find ourselves being governed by laws which have been agreed upon by several countries, but we draw them back to our own jurisdiction to make them applicable to our country. Then I would like members to look at a particular section in the Constitution, which is Section 231. All of that section talks to what really Parliament's role is and what the executive's role is in relation to international agreements. Subsection 1 there too says clearly that signing of treaties and agreements is the responsibility of the executive. Parliament has no problem with that. Negotiating, as you know, that agreements, you'll have to negotiate them first and then sign and then do the necessary treaty activities is a responsibility of the executive. It's an executive act. There's no problem with that. Then subsection 2, it says, however, much as signing of treaties and agreements is the responsibility of the executive, the two houses of parliament need to approve these agreements in order for them to be ratified. This is what subsection 2 is saying. It's a legal requirement of approval by two houses of parliament of treaties to be binding and only of certain agreements. It says only of certain agreements because of what I was explaining earlier, to say because they are executive, technical, and administrative agreements which do not require parliamentary approval. I've got some few examples here, but I'll refer to the handout which was given by the committee secretary. Mostly so that the committee will be able to identify which agreements are, you know, when you look at them, which ones are executive, technical, and administrative. But mostly you'll find them that at the end of, there is what we call final clauses in an agreement, is at the end of those agreements, it will say when the agreement will come into force. That's one which, you know, the easiest one which you can identify it. So it will say this agreement will enter into force on signature. So it means on signing the agreement comes into force. And when you check on the also competent authorities, you'll find that competent authorities, meaning people who are going to administer that certain agreement, it will be ministers. And in other areas, they won't mention ministers, competent authorities, it will be the Department of Human Settlement of South Africa and the Department of Human Settlement of India. So easily, on the face value, you can be able to say this is an this is an executive agreement because it's between the executives, or a technical agreement, you'll be able to tell because, for example, with agriculture, they would have maybe a livestock agreement to deal with livestock, you know, diseases of livestock, all those things which are technical. That's a technical agreement which necessarily wouldn't have to come to Parliament because the Parliament doesn't want to be bothered by small detail of what the executive can be doing. And then administrative, you'll find that half the time is the joint cooperation, bilateral cooperations of agreement which our country enters into with other countries. So that is executive because at times it's between the ministers of foreign affairs. They are the ones who are going to be administering the agreement, whereas there will be sectoral agreements coming out of that joint bilateral agreement. You'll find that different sectors pick on clauses which are relevant to them and have their own memorandum of understanding. I hope I'm not saying too many things at once. So that memorandum of understanding is another executive agreement because now it will be an understanding between two departments now, which has been born from the general agreement, which is a treaty between the two countries. Then a human settlement will take its component, agriculture will take its component, gender will take its component, culture will take its component. So all those sectors now can have their own memorandum of understandings, which the ministers will sign, or the heads of departments can sign. Now, with those, it doesn't mean if it's between the executives or technical experts within departments, Parliament has nothing to do with that. I think this is where there hasn't been emphasis. Parliament has oversight mandate over those agreements. What should happen is once the, Committee of Parliament knows, is made aware of such agreements, they should demand progress reports and they should actually oversee projects which emanate out of those agreements. It doesn't mean if they are executives, they are between ministers and it ends there. These agreements have to be are being implemented in our constituencies, they are being implemented in the country, so Parliament has to oversee this agreement, implementation of this agreement. So the key word for oversight is implementation of international agreements, which I'm saying has not been on the agenda of many committees since 1994 because of the backlog we had of laws, apartheid laws which Parliament had to repeal. Now, Section 231(3) now relates to what I have been talking about, that there are those agreements which are technical, administrative, executive, and they do not require ratification or accession, because I said if you have such an agreement and look at the back, the last provisions will say it will enter into force on signature. But there is a requirement, however, which I think most departments have been overlooking, which Parliament has to demand, that much as these agreements do not come to Parliament for ratification, they still have to come and be tabled for information within a reasonable time. Reasonable time, I think the drafters of the Constitution left it like that so that we are able to negotiate with the departments when we think they should present information, give committees information on this agreement. This will enable the committees now to devise their oversight strategies on this agreement. So if there is no information of what agreements that have been signed. There's no way of committees, you know, planning on their strategy for oversight on this agreement. So it is important that much as they don't come to Parliament for approval for ratification, they must come as information. Then the issue of approval, I've been saying approval for ratification and not ratification. What happens is the two houses, once an agreement has been tabled, has been referred and they discussed, then the word approval appears in the Constitution as it's on purpose to say just because ratification as such as an act is an executive act according to the Convention on the Law of Treaties, so Parliament has no executive function. So hence, Parliament only approves that, okay, we agree that this international agreement should be ratified. So even when committees discuss this instrument, then the report they give to the House is a recommendation for approval, not for ratification. Approval for ratification.
And one. And one.
Okay. There is a report. Actually, when these treaties are referred to committees, they are referred by so that the committee concerned can report back to the House. So once the committee has done that, both houses, by the way, have to agree. If there is disagreement, they have to confer. Definitely, there can be no two different recommendations on one agreement. That is the practice of Parliament. So once the committee has considered the agreement and they recommend approval or rejection, I must mention, it's either approval or rejection, such a recommendation has to be made to the House. And the way we write it, because I've seen some committees, the wording has not been correct, is that the committees recommend approval for ratification of agreement so and so. Not that the committee approves, not that the committee ratifies agreement so and so, because that is going to be done by the executive.
Yes, yes.
So, what Section 2, that approval by Parliament, what it means, this is very important, it means that before a treaty can come to Parliament for approval for ratification, that treaty is not binding on South Africa. It will only bind the Republic once it has been approved for ratification by the two houses. Then there is another proviso, because with lawyers we can never say we are done. There must be something else. Once ratification has been done by the executive, however, that treaty still has to come back to Parliament, now as a form of an act of Parliament of South Africa, now to implement that treaty, to domesticate the treaty. Unless that treaty is self-executing. Let me start by explaining a self-executing treaty and a clause, because a treaty can either as a whole be self-executing or it can contain clauses which are self-executing. Self-executing means automatic application. by law. So you have your, for example, the Constitutive Act of the African Union is self-executing. There is nothing any country can do about it to dissect it, to say, no, we don't want this clause, we want that clause, blah, 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 because it's a constitution of an organization to which we abide by. So when it comes to us, when it came to us, we adopted it in whole because it is self-executing. There are no changes to it. The Charter of the United Nations, mm-hmm. Same thing. The UN, WHO, WTO, all those encompassing, even on habitats, yes, we take them wholesome because they have been agreed by a multiple of people and they are actually a basis for the existence of such organizations. Okay. Now, some of these treaties which come to us as parliament, we need to be aware of the self-executing nature that they contain. If it's a wholesome agreement which cannot be changed, parliament should be aware of that. Then there are those which come to us with clauses which are self-executing, which really parliament has to be on the lookout for. Because if parliament and the executive have not identified such clauses, then we run the risk of having them applied in our country contrary to the constitution. For example, if we miss on identification of self-executing clauses within treaties that we are required to approve for ratification, we run the risk of having treaties that contain clauses that run contrary to our constitution. For example, I like treaties dealing with women.
Yes.
The rights of women again. This one, DECO was able to identify with all the relevant stakeholders when this treaty was dealt with. This treaty has a clause to say, especially the African Charter on the Rights of Women, it has a clause which says marriages must be registered and children must be registered. I'm interested on the marriages. So if your marriage has not been registered, you are not married. So what the African Union was trying to do was trying to cover, minorities. Some of these women in the rural areas where there is no registration and they have no right to domicile, even within their own countries, the situation in Zimbabwe at the moment. So they were trying to cover that. But in different jurisdictions, a different practice obtains. For example, in South Africa, registration of marriages. So registration of marriages, I'll give this one out. I think I didn't distribute it. Registration of Marriages Act also covers, legalizes even marriages which were not registered. The union. So those in our laws are covered. So that's self-executing clause in the AU Charter on the Rights of Women, the country was able to identify, to say, no, we will not agree to this clause. And so what happens in situations like that, there is what Parliament would suggest, a reservation.
Okay.
Approval with reservation on certain specific clause. So the end result will be the executive issuing what you call a reservation to a certain clause, to say this one was issued, to say with regards to registration of marriages, legality of marriages in South Africa, even those which are not registered are regarded as legal marriages. So it's clauses like that. It's within the constitution, so you can, the charter, so you can easily miss out on that. So what it says is that committees have to read the treaties word by word when they come before them and examine them and be sure that what the executive is saying, that they comply with the constitution, that there are no self-executing clauses, it's actually true. The other example is the one on death penalty. This one on death penalty, as we know, our constitution doesn't allow death penalty. So the convention which covered that, to say it should, it was catering for those jurisdictions which have death penalty, we had to reserve again to make a reservation on that one, to say in South Africa there is no need for catering for death penalty provisions, because our constitution actually doesn't allow death penalty. So it's issues like those. They're very small within a treaty. You can easily miss them out. So it needs to be read and examined. So that's what self-executing clauses are all about. They are very key matters. You won't find them in every treaty, but it's recommended that at least we should be sure that they are none, because they will apply to us regardless of whether, and they can actually be in contrast to the constitution, but they will be automatically applied once approval has been issued by Parliament for ratification. They don't need our national law. They don't need to be domesticated. This is the dangerous part in relation to executive, self-executing clauses. Then I think I should jump straight to what, because my time is running out. I should allow for questions. I should say, When committees deal with treaties, we are aware that they have to recommend approval or rejection. But there are certain questions which the committees, we recommend that they should ask themselves. What is this approval sought for? Is it sought for ratification, or is it sought for accession? I should explain those two words. Some of the departments will bring a request to Parliament for approval for ratification, whereas it's supposed to be accession. The difference is that where the executive has negotiated and signed agreements, where you have signed, the following process is a ratification. You ratify you authenticate your signature to an agreement. then normally those international agreements will be open for a certain period, maybe 6 months or 3 months, open for countries to sign. Then once you have signed, you go and ratify. But if that period of 3 months is closed, they are saying we no longer allow any signatures of this agreement, and it has entered into force. Because what happens is a convention will require 21, they will say we'll require 21 countries to sign and ratify. Then once we've got that 21, that convention comes into force. So whoever comes after the required two-thirds majority of such an instrument now can only accede. Now you assume what you were not able to sign before.
Mm-hmm.
So after two-thirds majority, after entry into force of such an instrument, you can only accede.
Then you are agreeing to the
other agreement. You are agreeing to what has been agreed upon, and it's life now. You're just following, actually. So that's the terminology. Then committees have to confirm compliance with domestic law. This is important. The departments send with this international instrument, they send what they call explanatory memorandum. And that explanatory memorandum, as far as we are concerned, I think it's still wanting. It doesn't have some of the very key information which Parliament needs. So what we are doing is, like this session now the committee will be able to say, discuss it and also make recommendations of what should also be contained in those explanatory memoranda. They are not wholesome. They don't give the whole picture. They will not be referring to self-executing clauses. They will not be referring to some of the things that we have tabled here. Then what is important also is what outcome under government priorities is the instrument addressing. This is not in the explanatory memorandum. Actually, this is what committees should be asking now. For all the international instruments and treaties that the departments they are monitoring have entered into, to say, tell us which priority were you relating this to, so that you take stock of implementation, you take stock of everything to say, actually, national interest is being addressed. There are some treaties with strategic political focus. This, I think, will not apply to all committees, but with our committee, it does. Because you'll find that, especially even with those five priorities of government, this strategic political focus will apply to say, this is on the agenda of government. So certain agreements and certain approaches have to be taken in line with what the priorities of government are. Then international obligations created. This is very important for committees to know what international obligations we have out there, what the executive has entered into, what is expected, so that we are able to draw up our strategy for oversight. It's based on that. What obligations do we have? If the treaty says you must have by now created a board or a board to deal with certain issues, is such a board in existence? If it needs amendment of laws, are those laws amended or what is happening? This one, the following one, implications for vulnerable groups is very important. With human settlement, this is crucial. if you're going to have houses, maybe donors building houses for you, which disabled people cannot access, then we need to address that. Vulnerable groups do suffer a lot in these international treaties. Their rights are forgotten most of the time. So it's for Parliament to make sure that some of these things are covered. Then the self-executing clauses, which we have already discussed. And then financial and security implications. Some of these treaties, actually they come to Parliament because they are supposed to have financial implications. So every bit of it should be declared so that Parliament knows what kind of budget will be needed for the implementation of this instrument. Every bit of it should be expressed. Security implications, some of the treaties, you'll find that Parliament can be more sensitive to the sovereignty of the country, maybe something that the executive would have overlooked. To say if you enter into, for example, if you enter into a treaty with a warring country, maybe where there is, I mean, Iraq, for example, I'll take an outrageous example. Now, that will be a security, it has security implications for the country. So Parliament can raise that to say, much as we agree that we can have foreign relations with so many, but at the moment we see the situation as not stable. So we'd like to advise, you know, reconsideration. Then approval or rejection. This is what I was saying, that you can either approve or reject, but the response has to be the same from both houses. Then Rule 307 of our NA rules does say the rejection and or approval should be in writing. And why in writing? I think it is important to for the committee to note that once you have discussed an agreement and, okay, maybe I should make this distinction clear. For ratification of international instruments, the committee, Parliament cannot change the treaty because it comes to us, which is another issue which the Parliament will have to discuss. It comes to us at the end of the line. It's effective. We negotiate, we sign, then ratification, it comes to us. So all this multilateral fora has agreed on the content of the treaty. So when it comes to us in Parliament, it's just for us to, yes, but we are advocating that we are not just going to approve and or reject. We discuss these treaties and make our concerns in writing to say the advantage of recommending certain things, much as you can't change them, is that when the treaty now comes back as an act of Parliament, all those concerns which the committee had will be included now in our national law. That you can chop and change. You can chop and change that treaty and say we'll talk, I mean, like the example I gave, we will not have a registration of marriages as the only way of legalizing marriages. That one we chopped out from the treaty because we have a law now which says even the unions are legal marriages. So once you have discussed the treaty and you have put all those concerns, when it comes back now as an act of Parliament, you are able to choose what you want in your law. This is very important, and this is something that Parliament has to be aware of. You can now deal with it, but you cannot change it when it comes for ratification, for approval for ratification, it's a done deal, and Parliament will discuss, you know, where it thinks it can maybe be involved somehow during the negotiations. That I'll leave to members to think about. Then this is just something which the explanatory memorandum doesn't have, and I've already discussed some of them, but really clearly there must be reasons why we are becoming parties to such, and obligations assumed, environmental, social and cultural effects of the treaty, implementation strategy. We should know how the department is planning to implement and what should be implemented, and whether there is a clause for withdrawal, reservation, denunciation, because you'll find them in most of these treaties, they will allow you, because these are sovereign states, they are allowed to have reservations, they are allowed to withdraw from the treaty, they are allowed to denounce the treaty, they are allowed, there are so many things that you can do with treaties. But as people from international relations would say, let's have our treaties and let's have a way of working around them so that we implement them. We don't want to become like maybe what the U.S., withdrawing from treaties. We don't assign treaties. We want to have a way of implementing them, helping the executive to implement. I thank you.
You know, that was very much interesting. But that what you can do, let's get clarity seeking questions. But now I would like you just to touch on the example that we have provided, not just to indicate what type, what is required from us on this particular China thing with the Mpumalanga. The critical issues that we need to do as the portfolio committee, because we can see that you talk of the vulnerability of the people, and now when you get there, you'll find that the people of Mpumalanga are not employed there so that they can access those technical skills, those Chinese they are bringing. So they bring their own people to do the work without making sure that the people of that area are inclusive, so that when they left the urban Malandau, they must continue the Fumene additional skills. Even those artisans we have, we believe that they can have something extra from those China people. But let me give the members just to get the seeking clarification. Let's make it quick, short questions. Mami Jobe, Honorable Stain, Honorable Stole, Honorable Ficklan, Honorable Doris, and then last one.
No.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. Earlier on, I would have asked the question. Let me first say thank you very much for this presentation. It's usually a very difficult and, I must say, very dull area, you know, to look at the treaties. But I think the presentation here has made it quite interesting, I must say. Actually, it's the first time I listened to such an interesting presentation on the treaties. Now, the thing is, the treaties come to us already prepared, negotiated, about, and signed. Now, my question then would have been, if Parliament does not agree, it's been signed already between the department, the government, and the other country, and the department of another country. If Parliament rejects it, what then happens? I think you say we can.
can reject it, but then what happens?
Can we recommend amendments as Parliament to a treaty that has been done elsewhere? Now, you are saying that treaties must be followed by laws or acts of Parliament so that they can be implemented. Now, I don't think we have done that in our Parliament, as Parliament. It may have been done by, I mean, the laws emanate from the department, isn't it? Yeah, our laws emanate from the department. Can we then say, of all the treaties that have been signed since 1994, we have the laws to implement those treaties? If not, what can be done? You earlier on spoke of a backlog. What do you mean by this backlog?
Okay.
Now, the question of involvement of Parliament during a negotiation, I'm not able to picture at what stage that is possible. Because, as I say, the treaties usually come to us already ready-made. So at what stage could Parliament be involved during the time of the negotiation? How do you do that? I'm sorry, I've not read the Chinese Mpumalanga Agreement temperature, so I don't think I'll be able to ask any questions on that. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome, Honorable. Your apologies. I know you were in the party where I came from.
Thank you, Chairperson. Some of my questions have been covered. What happens to a treaty? What happens to a treaty that, in fact, is approved in Parliament as well? But and it links on to some of the questions, but no act to provide for the implementation of it has followed that. What's the sort of international norm for a reasonable time period to elapse between the actual signature and when it needs to be tabled in Parliament? And then you gave a very apt example of the registration of marriages, for example, which may from the African Union constitution or treaty that is in conflict with what we accept. But earlier you indicated in something like the African Union, one of those bodies, when we actually sign that particular treaty, if that is what it's called, your specific words were that we take it in its completion. And then, like I say, you gave the example, but it differs to what we currently have. So there's just a little bit of a contradiction in what you've said and the way you've said it. So you also said that if there are no reservations expressed by Parliament, that particular treaty is automatically applied. Now, I just want to change this around a little bit from my earlier question. If that treaty is in fact in conflict with our constitution, then I think the clause 4 in our constitution then says that it's not binding on us. But you did very specifically say that if no reservations are expressed, then it automatically applies. So again, I need just some clarity on that. You've also said Parliament cannot change treaties, but we can include changes when we enact the law. However, again, it's just a little bit of a contradiction for me. You also then said, you know, it's a done deal when it's been tabled. So you haven't expressed reservations. The treaty therefore becomes binding. But when we then do the law, the act on it, we find something that we're not comfortable with, and in our law we change it. So it just seems to be things that seem to be clashing. There's no clarity for me as to what we can, what we can't, when it's binding, when it's not.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think most of my questions have been asked, but only the one that I want to find out, you'll be talking about backlog of international agreement. Do the department have that backlog? The Department of Human Security? and then the other one is the third one of the explanatory agreement, memorandum. What I want to find out the kind of agreement that have signed under that explanatory memorandum. And the other one, Chair, is that one of binding of Parliament. It says becoming binding without the parliamentary approval, but be tabled in the two houses within reasonable time. If they are talk about reasonable time, how long does that should be? Because we cannot just say this is reasonable time. And another one, Chair, is that one of approval and rejection. If the two houses, if one did approve and the other rejected, what happened?
Okay, Honorable.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I've been covered. And the other question that I'm interested in the Chinese agreement. When we were there, we believed that the Chinese wanted to bring their own artisans to help South Africa with their houses. But now, as we know, we're short of skills, and we need our community to be equipped with different workmanship. Now, does that complicate the agreement between the two countries? And then the last question that I wanted to ask is about what happened if, because we've got 3 spheres of government. Now, what happened if one province make agreement with another country to be helped, like in human settlement? Do we support that or we don't support it? Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, I think I've been partly covered by yourself and the other members. I was only interested in knowing the type of agreement we entered into with the Chinese people and the issue of violating vulnerable groups in terms of building this kind of houses, because as we recall, we've been in Tuscop. The houses are not user-friendly, especially for people with disabilities. So what is it that we can do as a committee? Maybe to recommend amendments or what? Thank you, Chair.
Honorable comment?
Okay.
Yes, I just perhaps would follow on this Chinese thing with the houses. And to add there, when these treaties are entered into, is it just a big overall sort of a budget and so many houses and that, and no sort of criteria, you know, to cover the sort of thing that our concerns are? For example, the local skills, you know, whether that also is included or whether it's just a sort of a blanket thing. And maybe that's where we as a portfolio committee need to exercise our oversight a bit better over the treaties. I think this self-executing provision is for me quite a challenge. And I think it would be a priority for us as a committee to get up all these treaties. I don't know if we've got a lot of them or we've only got a few of them when you talk about the backlog that pertain to human settlements. But I think we do need to look at that very carefully. I think otherwise my concerns are covered, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think let me protect you in terms of how many the backlog of human settlements or how many treaties we have, because we are still going to have a meeting with the department, I think next week or the other week. They have to bring all the treaties that they have within the department. So I think we will put pressure on them to submit those presentations earlier on so that we consult. So so that we consult with you before we meet with the department. So we will need your assistance now and again until the dismissing day. Otherwise, you can respond to the rest, because we are interested on this China thing. Because when the department comes before us, because really there are a lot of issues that we are asking ourselves, a lot of questions in terms of this agreement.
Thank you, Chair. Also, just to say, even with the issue of local skills, I want to believe that the MOU, which this exchange of notes, this is an exchange of notes, which the Chinese and South Africa government have entered into, agreeing on details of what this what the housing project will all be about. So I want to believe that an MOU detailing these must have been brought before the committee for information. If not, it must be, so that the committee is able to hold the department to account. There is no way you'll be able to deal with it unless, but I want to believe maybe an MOU was tabled for information so you can hold the department to account, so that the issue of skills and other concerns can be raised there. Then, Chair, on the issue of signature, whether signature and ratification, which is, you know, how does this thing work? When the country enters into an agreement and signs, if it's a multilateral treaty and it signs it, signature means my intention to be, to, in principle, agree to the contents of the agreement, and you end there. So the reason for having a ratification or an accession afterwards is now to, for the country, as a sovereign country, to say, now I'm ready to be bound. So they are different. Mm-hmm. They are different stages. You can have your agreement and have it signed and it sits there. For years, this is what happens with countries. For years, you can just sign to say, in principle, I will not be in conflict with this, the principle of this agreement. But until such time that you issue an instrument of ratification, now you are bound by it. So there is that difference. So countries as sovereign states, they give themselves time to think deeply. Also, to some countries, will, before they actually ratify, they have laws. They enact laws which will be implementing a treaty before they ratify. That's what other jurisdictions do. They insist that there must be laws before we ratify. Some jurisdictions, it will be after ratification. So there is a difference. The Parliament cannot amend treaties, as I said. We can only look at them, examine them, but have our concerns in writing. Because these concerns, much as we approve, we'll be approving, but we'll have a report going together with that approval to the department to say, however, be aware of ABCD. So that when this treaty comes back as an act of Parliament now, you are able to bring your arrows out and say, this is what we are saying. So which brings me back to, yes, with treaties, there is, I was referring to the African Union Treaty, the Constitutive Act, which is the constitution of the African Union. That one is self-executing as it is. But when I was referring to the registration of customary marriages, it's now a convention, a treaty within the African Union, which is not that umbrella body. So this one, the Treaty on Rights of Women, does have clauses which South Africa did not accept. And as a result, in order to avoid them to come to us and be applied here, we reserved our position on them. So that's the difference. The main constitution of the African Union we have adopted. Then, yes, I agree with you. What I was explaining is a bit different. Article 231(4) says the self-executing treaty unless it is contrary to the constitution. Indeed, if you are going to have a treaty saying, you know, selling of weapons of mass destruction, and we become party to that, definitely it's inconsistent with our constitution and it will not apply. So it relates to that, to say if anything is self-executing, then it will have to, I mean, it will be inconsistent with our constitution and it will not apply. But the thing is, as committees and as a parliament, we need to be able to identify those things before they can be declared in the constitutional court that actually this treaty is unconstitutional. We try to avoid work that is done by parliament to be quashed by the constitutional court. We should do it here, examine them. Then I have said changes of treaties. You can be able to pick from a treaty. You don't change it when it comes here for ratification. But when it comes back now to implement, for example, let me make an example so that now we have a convention on the law of the seas. Maybe I'm going too far. The easiest one will be, so once you have a general convention on the law of the sea, it says 200 nautical miles is a free ozone area where fishing can be done. Then it has area where from what point it will be international waters. So we need to regulate as South Africa to say, but me and, let me make a good example. We have a treaty with Namibia on water courses. So if we have such a treaty, and then the Lesotho one, yes, then we need to, from that treaty, in order to implement it, we negotiated exactly what is going to be applicable in South Africa. We pick on issues like if we are downstream, there should be no polluting of the water, there should be access by vulnerable groups at the end of the stream, blah, 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 things like that. We regulate that in accordance with our standards. We will not set standards for other countries, but we'll set them indirectly. We'll say, for the water in order to come, I mean, to be usable in South Africa, it has to meet, unfortunately, ABCD. A stamp of SABS is this. So much alkali, so much acidity, la, 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 la. But it's in a treaty, the part that we are going to apply, which we agree, we negotiate with Lesotho, we negotiate with Namibia, we introduce our own standards into the treaty. So we cannot leave it at that level where it's unregulated, it won't benefit our people, it will not be acceptable to our standards. We negotiate into it. So with a treaty, an international treaty, it comes to Parliament, and you are able now to take the concerns which you raised before and say, in actual fact, if now we are going to be building houses, then we need to look at local skills improvement. We need to look at people. You know, it's things like that which now Parliament can be able to introduce some of the local ingredients so that such treaties are actually beneficial to the people on the ground. Then, reasonable time. You know, know, with legal minds, reasonable time is reasonable time. according to international law, it's a norm. Yeah, it's normal time, which acceptable time that if you have signed an agreement with China in December, reasonable time is that once you have done all the necessary, the constitutional requirements, you've met them, bring it to Parliament. So I think committees, I mean, Parliament as an institution will need to have that, you know, to negotiate with departments to see what is a reasonable time. It's a very tricky one for a lawyer, but yes, it's very tricky, but it's within acceptable time, so that you don't forget. You should get these things while they're still hot, to say, is this what you signed? Then implementation says, please include ABCD. So, reasonable time is. And then involvement of Parliament. Involvement of Parliament is being discussed generally, even internationally. Parliaments are claiming their stake within international agreements. As you know, decisions that were taken were traditionally meant for Parliament to take are now being taken outside our borders. If you talk of trade issues, trade relations, tariffs, they are being determined in Geneva for the people in South Africa. WTO is doing that. ILO is determining labor relations. WHO is saying this is what health will look like. So parliaments are slowly being sidelined. So it's time for Parliament to take its place and say we still need to be involved. So it's for Parliament now to decide when, at what stage, and what you want to do, taking into consideration that indeed negotiations take long and at times they are fast. So by the time, because what Parliament has, the only good thing which Parliament possesses is public participation. So public participation takes time. So I don't know. With other institutions, I mean jurisdictions which I have read, they do what they call a mandate to the executive to say if you're going to be talking about fisheries, this is what, you know, negotiate along this mandate. And because negotiations are evolving, so by the time they come to Parliament, blah, blah. So it's just where should Parliament fit and how, which we need to discuss as Parliament. And the backlog, my chairperson has already touched on that. And, okay, provinces. This one actually is the issue which the committee I support is dealing with. Provinces are signing agreements with different countries. In principle, there is nothing wrong with that. It's an issue which you can also discuss with the department when it's here. It's just that I know DICO is complaining about coordination. To say twinning of municipalities, twinning of cities, twinning of these things are done. You can have relations with different countries, maybe, you know, agreeing on like Lesotho and Swaziland. They are very near, so there are rescue missions going on. So firefighters agree to say if there is a problem, we'll bring our fire, you know, vehicles, extinguishing vehicles. If there is a disaster, we'll come and rescue you. It seems like that they happen, but they happen within. There must be an umbrella agreement which Parliament would have known about. They must operate within an established relation. If there is nothing like that, in fact, all of them operate because there is some kind of relation. It's just that I'm making the committee aware that actually there would have been, you know, would have had established diplomatic relations with China for our municipality to have gone there. They wouldn't go to which country doesn't, they wouldn't have gone to any other country unless we have established diplomatic relations to start with. So within that umbrella, there are activities, but they need to be coordinated so that the left hand knows what the right hand is doing.
I think you have reached the your mark in this one, because everything is clear. But because this is the first time that we engage on this matter, so at some stage we're always knocking at your door to need assistance until the squazo kena. Ona onfisa kaka ngoku. Then gina se streamy legging ngoku. At least you can say you are on your own. But for now, this is our kubege, we still continue OTC, sicela assistance yako. Honorable members, I think we have to thank the lady. What's her name? Mosala. Dineo, yeah. We have to thank Dineo. She has done great and is going to assist when the department comes before us. Hey, yes, Saba. Also, has told me, because now, even for this one, they took advantage of us by sending this document instead of sending all the documents. Because I requested all the documents relating to this, and then firstly, they decided to send us a report. And then I said, no, we don't want a report only, a progress report. We want the exact MOU that was signed. Then they sent it, they left the other information. So I think now when they are coming next week, I would write a letter on behalf of the committee to them to say when they come, they must bring the detailed information about this, so that we can see what was there in that agreement. Otherwise, Ms. Nkize, I think you can say something, because you are helping us a lot. You will land and also.
Thank you. I was hoping that letter, before it goes out, if we can give it to Ms. Mosala to go through it, to ensure that what you required is all there in that letter. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. You are very much sorry for taking much of your time, because I understand that next door they are waiting for you, Dineo. Thank you very much. Honorable members, I think let's. I've been informed that today there is a birthday. I think Koliswa will take KK and bring to your offices Ms. Nkize and Dineo for Honorable Doris. Doris is the head birthday. Maya, and Mbo, two. There are two. Okay. I think we have to sing for them.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. Happy birthday to you,
Dorian.
Happy birthday to you.
To you, too. Hooray! Honourable members, we won't have these reports that we are expecting today, and this is an unfortunate situation, because I think it's almost a month, but we all know that our secretary was not there, so we had other secretaries. So those reports are not ready, but I've consulted with the management of committee section that those reports really, by next week, because they are very important. The USDG is very crucial that we finalize those reports. So I apologize, Honorable Members. So after KK, we are released.
Thank you.
Never?
How are you?
The meeting is adjourned.
I don't see you.
No.
I've been attacked by this man. And an impact in Pumalana. And you are not there, no one will protect me. Job at five to protect me, they deal with me.
Okay.
Okay.